Hey everyone, before we start this episode of FW Presents Mountain Comics, we want to thank our sponsor, which is InStockTrades.com. Now, of course, normally we would do the InStock Trades ad in the middle of the show, but I didn't want to embarrass my guest, J.M. DeMatteis, by plugging some of his own work in front of him, so I'm doing it here at the top of the show. InStock Trades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 45% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. And of course, two of the books that I'm going to be plugging are both by my guest, J.M. DeMatteis. First up is New Defenders Trade Paperback Volume 1, which reprints Defenders 122 through 124 and New Defenders 125 through 131. This was a really fun run of this book. I remember buying these off the stands. Of course, it's written by J.M. DeMatteis, as I said, also Peter McGillis. The artists are Don Perlin, Alan Kupperberg, Sal Buscema, and Mike Zeck. The cover is by Bill Sienkiewicz, 256 pages. The normal price is $29.99. InStock Trades price is $17.39. That's 42% off. This was back when the team consisted of like Beast, Angel, Iceman, Moondragon, Valkyrie, Gargoyle. It was a really fun book, and JM did a really great run of stories in this book. So that's New Defenders, Trade Paperback Volume 1. And the other book I want to plug is, more currently, Scooby Apocalypse Volume 1, which is, of course, again, written by J.M. DeMatteis and Keith Giffen, art by Howard Porter. And this is the sort of reimagining of the Scooby gang. It says, when the world is tossed into chaos, it's up to a group of meddling kids, Fred, Daphne, Velma, and Shaggy, and their dog Scooby-Doo, to solve the mystery and survive hordes of zombies. But can they save the day and cure everyone, or will they become brain-eating zombies themselves? The creature of the nights are among us, and the crew of the mystery machine has to fight to survive, because in the apocalyptic badlands of the near future, the horrors are real. It collects Scooby Apocalypse 1 through 6. I think I remember when this first was announced, people were a little skeptical of like, really, do we need this? But then when I heard that JM was writing, I thought, well, that's like the perfect guy, because JM really knows how to kind of handle this kind of tricky tone. And everyone really loves this book. It's very popular and it's a lot of fun. So pick up both of these books if you're a fan of JM's work, as I am. Scooby Apocalypse Volume 1 and New Defenders Trade Paperback Volume 1. For these and all your other trade paperback needs, visit InStockTrades.com. We thank them for their support. And now, on with the show. September, October, November. Have a time you'll always remember. At beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Make your fall fabulous at Mount Airy Lodge and Pocono Gardens. Do all the things you wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 1-800-441-4410 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to another episode of FW Presents, the omnibus show for the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is yet another installment in my Mountain Comics series where I talk about comics that I bought while I was on vacation with my parents up in the Poconos during the 70s and 80s. And for this installment, I'm talking about Captain America number 263, which was on sale August 4th, 1981. It's written by J.M. DeMatteis, drawn by Mike Zeck and Frank McLaughlin. And I thought, who would be more appropriate to talk to about this particular comic, which is so beloved to me, than J.M. DeMatteis himself? So hello, J.M., and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I'm really, really thrilled to have you here. Now, this comic was particularly big for me. In fact, I loved it so much that back when we were on vacation, I took a picture. I had my family actually take a picture of me holding it, and we'll see that on the gallery post for this particular installment, where you see my dad in the background and my mom and a family friend, and there I am holding the Captain America comic book. I just was so in love with this particular issue. Captain America was and still is my favorite Marvel character, and I thought Captain America was weirdly a book that I didn't always see on the newsstands when I lived at home, due to the weird newsstand distribution stuff. So when I saw it on sale up in the mountains, as I called them, I always picked it up. And this is a particularly good installment. Like I said, the title of the story in particular is The Last Movie. And, you know, JM, it's taken me many years to realize how many times you snuck in movie titles for your stories. I never realized that half the, like a lot of your Aquaman stories, I'm like, oh, Grand Illusion. Oh, that's so.
Oh, yeah. The Aquaman stories, it was really conscious. I think every single one of those stories had a movie title.
Right. So here we've got The Last Movie, which, of course, for anyone who doesn't know, was a movie by Dennis Hopper from the 70s. And this in this issue, it's the conclusion of a multi-part story. And so this issue opens with first of all, it has a great cover by Mike Zeck of Captain America fighting the larger robot version of himself, and then you get Red Skull in the background playing the sort of puppet.
Which I imagine if you're a kid, what could be cooler than Captain America fighting an evil giant Captain America,
right? Oh, it's
right?
A hell of a cover. I mean, it's just, for 50 cents, you're like, and you got the Red Skull yelling, "At my command, the Ameridroid shall finally destroy Captain America." I mean, it's, there's no way you're not dropping two quarters for this book. So it ends with the Red Skull commands the Ameridroid to attack Captain America. During their battle, Cap is able to get through to Lyle Decker's human side, helping him overcome the Skull's control. Decker attacks the Skull, but is overpowered by the Skull's force field. Cap then attacks, discovering that this particular Red Skull is a robot. Captain America follows the Skull's lead to Democracy Pictures, where he battles an army of nihilist order agents. Cap eventually finds himself in the Galactic Films owner's office, where the Skull awaits. Red Skull reveals that by discrediting Captain America, he was able to guarantee everyone in the country would watch his pre-made Cap documentary laced with hypnotic suggestions that will induce a violent frenzy in the populace. Decker bursts into the office and attacks the Skull, causing an explosion that apparently destroys Red Skull and Galactic Studios. Captain America seizes the only copy of the documentary before it can air and burns it. So, Jam, we have so many things to ask you about, but I don't want to monopolize your afternoon. This particular story, I mean, where did you get the notion of this whole idea of, Captain America making a movie, having a movie about himself, and then the Red Skull using sort of propaganda to thwart the idea of people, being on Cap's side? Do you remember where you got that notion?
Well, the weirdly interesting, I hope it's interesting, story behind the story is, if some people will remember that back in the 70s, Marvel was doing a bunch of TV movies. They had a hit with the Incredible Hulk TV series. They did they had a short run of Spider-Man. They did a Doctor Strange TV movie. And they did a Captain America TV movie that the less we say about it, the better. But it succeeded enough that they were doing a sequel TV movie. So this is very, very early in my career. I was mostly working for DC, but sort of getting a foot in at Marvel. And Jim Shooter came to me and said, "Well, they're doing this new Captain America TV movie. We want to do a Captain America." Remember the big Treasury editions?
Of course.
A Captain America Treasury edition that somehow ties in to this TV movie. Not that it's an adaptation of the movie, but somehow the story would tie in to the movie itself, to the making of the movie. So the original version of the story, believe it or not, featured the actor that played Captain America.
Reb Brown.
Reb Brown. Right. And so I don't have I never saved a copy of that version, but the idea is that, somehow Cap got involved with the making of that movie. So the bones of this story were all in that story. And this, like I said, very early in my career, you don't say no. When you want to work at Marvel, if they say, you want to do Millie the Model meets, meets Mary Tyler Moore, you'll say, yes, I'll do that, So I was thrilled with the gig, but I was actually very happy and relieved when someone woke up one morning and went, "These TV movies are terrible. We don't really want to tie in with that." I'm assuming that was the logic behind it. And after I'd written it, they canceled that project.
Oh, man. I love the Treasuries. I would have killed to see that. Oh, man.
Right. So, but then, I don't know whether it was Shooter's idea or Jim Salkrep, who was the editor of Captain America, they knew that this story, it was a long story because those Treasury editions were long, 60, 70 pages, whatever they were. And they said, "Why don't we adapt this story, take out, any references to the TV movie, and let's adapt this story. We can make three issues of the Captain America comic book out of it." I was not the official Captain America writer yet. This was just, "Hey, we've got this stuff laying around. Let's see if we can adapt it and use it." So that's where the whole Hollywood aspect of the story came from, which doesn't take a lot to convince me because I love stories of Hollywood, especially old Hollywood, and the big studios and all that stuff. I was very hooked on this new Amazon series, The Last Tycoon, which unfortunately they've canceled because I am just such a sucker for that kind of Hollywood stuff. So I adapted the story. And then, You know, the flip side is I've always been fascinated with this idea of what someone wrote a book years ago called Subliminal Seduction. And the idea of affecting people's minds, buying habits, whatever it is, with subliminals. You know, I'm going to get the technical details right. You know, they used to say that back in the day in movie theaters, every 20th frame of the film, they would, I don't know whether it's even true, but this is the concept, they would slip in a picture of popcorn. You went by so fast, your conscious mind couldn't see it, but your unconscious mind would pick up on it. So after these things went by a little bit, I have an urge to get up and go out into the lobby and buy some popcorn or get a soda. And there's a whole history of subliminal advertising and things like that. And so the idea was to take the whole idea of this subliminal seduction and what can you make people do? And so for the skull to get all these eyeballs on the TV and then put in these subliminal messages to make them crazy. Obviously, it's a comic book, so it's not like buying popcorn. They all want to go out into the streets and essentially destroy each other and destroy the country, you know? So I just thought that was I thought it was a cool idea to insert. I think that idea was probably in the original Treasury Edition idea. But who knows? It's been so long, I couldn't swear to anything.
That's amazing. That's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's good to know that, you know, we don't have to deal with pro-Nazi propaganda anymore. Thank God we solved that problem.
Right, yeah, we've gotten past that.
Yeah. that's I mean, of course, you know, the history of sort of this pro-Nazi, I mean, the Nazis knew that propaganda really worked. I mean, going all the way back to Leni Riefenstahl and stuff like that. I mean,
So
you would make sense that the skull would know how to kind of utilize it. That's really interesting. I do want to ask you a little bit about your view of Captain America as a character, because I mean, you're taking over Captain America. For people who don't know, don't remember the context, you know, this is 1981. Ronald Reagan had just become president, and we had come out of the 70s where America as a country was sort of had taken a sort of beating, and it wasn't particularly cool to be patriotic necessarily, and Ronald Reagan was trying to sort of reinstill that. And I think some writers probably had a little difficulty with Captain America because it's, you know, in a time where the country wasn't terribly proud of itself, here you've got a guy who's a walking flag. Do you remember what your view of that character was? I mean, when you took it out, were you concerned about it?
Yeah, I wasn't concerned at all. You know, it's interesting too, because as a writer, what I find happens sometimes, there are characters you may love and you sit down to write them, and as a writer something doesn't quite connect. You realize you're better as an audience for that character than you are as the writer for that character. Other characters, you may like them going in, but when you start to write them you kind of fall in love with them. And that was my experience with Captain America. I always read Captain America. There are certain runs, you know, that I really, really loved. Obviously, Lee and Kirby, Steve Englehart's run is amazing, you know, Stern and Byrne, which came not long before when I took over. But it wasn't until I started writing the character that something clicked. And in terms of that whole sort of, you know, uber patriotism thing, I never bridled at that, because that to me wasn't the character. Mm-hmm. The character, and I'm not the only writer that said this, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure Englehart and Stern and all those guys probably felt the same way. Not that I want to speak for them, but if you look at their work, I think it's pretty clear. Captain America is not representative of the country as it is. Captain America is representative of the highest ideals of this country. You know, and the fun of the character is that, you know, on that larger scope, is that tug of war between those ideal, the American ideal and the American reality, which, you know, right now you turn on the TV every day and it's beyond a tug of war, you know? But that's what made writing that character on that level so interesting to me. And then, of course, Stern had done a lot of work trying to humanize the character and give Steve Rogers a life, and I really appreciated that. I've said this before, I think Roger is the great unsung hero of 80s Marvel. There is hardly a book at Marvel that he touched that wasn't just superb, you know, really superb, wonderful, wonderful writer. And I was lucky enough to build on things that he had done and then develop them and add my own things to it, you know. And I didn't have a problem with that. I have a problem in life with that sort of, you know, my country right or wrong, flag developing, nationalism, which we're seeing in a really horrible, distorted form right now. But I never viewed Cap that way. He's not about that, you know. And as I think it was Stern that said, you know, this is a kid who grew up, during the Roosevelt, came of age during the Roosevelt era. You know, he was probably if he had a political affiliation, he was probably a New Deal Democrat.
Right.
And, So no, I never had a problem with that. I went right to the sort of the idealistic core of the character.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is an extraordinary run. I mean, you did the book from numbers 261 all the way to 300, which is that's a
right. There were a few fill-ins that the people did along the way, but mostly it was all me. Yeah.
Now, why did you eventually decide to move on? Just to feel like you sort of did your bit. You made your statement and time to move on to other projects.
No, this is another story. It's a long story that I'll shorten. I did a year-long storyline with Paul Neary. Did the art. He was drawing the book at the time. That was, in my mind, the final battle with the Red Skull. And it would climax in Captain America number 300 with this showdown between the two. The Red Skull has aged. He's old now. He knows he's dying. And before he dies, he wants to take down Steve Rogers and everyone he loves. And he has also infected Steve with this disease so that he has aged as well. And I believe they did something like that recently in the book where he aged also. But anyway, this is, you know, so these two old men are having their final battle. And the upshoot was going to be that once it was over and Steve was restored, you know, he looks around and he sees that, you know, everyone he loves and holds dear was almost destroyed by this battle. And, you know, he's at this point, he'd been doing this for 40-something years. You know, solve the problems by punching the bad guy in the face or dropping the building on his head. And Cap, to me, being the idealist that he is at his core, would look around and say, you know what? There's got to be another way to do this. There's got to be another way to affect positive change in the world other than ultimately solving these problems with violence. And so it was going to be a year or two long quest for him to find that way, to try to see if there was a way to affect change nonviolently in the world. And a part of the fun of that would be that he would have to unlearn 40 years of behavior. So even though he may espouse these ideals, you know, at the first sign of violence, his first reflex is going to be to punch the guy in the face. But ultimately, he was going to be a figure leading a world peace movement in which the government would turn against him, the other heroes in the Marvel Universe, many of them would turn against him, and the plan was that the only allies, real allies he was going to find, were the Submariner and Doctor Doom, who all lined up with him because they both realized in their own ways, for their own reasons, that, you know, the world can't go on this way and there really must be peace. And it was going to end, you know, I had a Nomad, who was the Bucky of the 50s, as his partner, with him basically he snapping and assassinating Captain America, something else that they did years later, you know, but I'll be doing this in 1983 or whatever it was. Long story short, well, it's already a long story, but longer story shorter, Mark Gruenwald was my editor. Mark was a great guy. I loved working with him. He was a great editor and a good friend, and we still miss him. And he approved it, and I started work on it. And then word got up to Jim Shooter, who was the editor-in-chief, who said, you're not doing this. His line was, as I recall, my Captain America would never do that. Or, you know, his vision of Captain America made no sense to him. It made perfect sense to me, and I think it actually makes perfect sense for the character. And the topper was then Cap was going to get assassinated at the end, and I was playing with the idea of either the Falcon or this character I had in the book called Black Crow, who was a Native American, one of them becoming Captain America to replace him. And I believe they ultimately, years later, I believe Steve Rogers did become Captain America for a time, Sam Wilson.
Sam Wilson, yeah.
What I finally decided, though, was that the first Americans, you know, the Native Americans, that should be our new Captain America. So I was going to have a Native American Captain America. So it was a story that I think, had it been done at the time, would have been really, really powerful and really significant and would have really, you know, shaken things up in a really good way. Now, at the same time, I was really, really upset at the time, and I quit the book because that's why I left the book. But, you know, as, you know, time goes by and you look at things with different eyes, and I saw, you know, Shooter was doing his job. His job was to be the custodian of the Marvel Universe and look over all those characters. And if from his perspective that story didn't work, you know, that's his writer's editor-in-chief to torpedo that story. I also think that when you have a story where one of your major icons is saying violence isn't the way, and you have an entire line of books where every month people are beating each other up, you know?
Right, yeah.
It's sort of undermining the very foundations of your universe. So I think, I don't know whether it's conscious or not, but I think that must have somehow affected the decision-making process, you know?
Yeah.
If your story is saying, you know what, guys, what we do is fundamentally flawed, that's a pretty heavy thing to put out in a Marvel comic, you know, in 1983.
Yes, especially coming from Captain America, who is sort of the natural leader of this whole universe. I mean, he's really, to me, the Superman of this universe. I mean, Spider-Man may be the more popular character, but Captain America is sort of the ultimate moral authority. In the Marvel Universe, and it's something they've replicated in the movies. And I think that's why there's something watching this, rereading this comic, there's something so amazingly powerful. He said you've got, as you talked about, him fighting himself, where he's fighting the sort of larger version of himself. And just the idea of the Red Skull using, again, going back to the propaganda kind of thing, of Captain America sacrificing himself so heavily for what he believes in, and having it all be undermined. I mean, the scene you write where we see Red Skull's plan as how he wants it to come true, and we see the rioting going on. It's a really, really powerful image, you know, because it's like, you know, that Captain America is sort of is kind of always right, generally, not in a boring way, but he's always sort of, his compass is always north, and to see him, you know, to see him undermine like this. And so the idea of as you're talking about, like almost undermining the whole Marvel universe. Yeah, I could sort of see why Jim Shooter would be a little concerned about that.
Well, the great postscript to this story is when after I left the book, I said, I love this idea. What can I do with it? You know, and I messed around with it for years. I created my own character to go with it, you know, my own universe of characters. And every few years I dust it off and rewrite it and pitch it somewhere, and nobody got it. You know, nobody got it. And like 25 years went by. 2008 or 9, I was talking to my friend Mike Cavallaro, a wonderful artist, and saw some recent work of his, and I thought, my God, he would be great for this story. It was called The Life and Times of Savory 28. So I took some of Mike's art, and I dusted off my little proposal, and I sent it off to Chris Ryle at IDW. And this has never happened before or since. I sent this proposal in the morning, and it was approved that afternoon.
Nice!
So I waited 25 years to get an instant approval. You know? And so we did this five-issue series, which is out in a collection for anyone to buy, and called The Life and Times of Savior 28. And it turned into, I think, probably the single best superhero story I've ever done. I'm very, very proud of the story. And if I had to wait 25 years to do it, it was worth the wait, you know? And having my own universe of characters, and we literally had to create an entire universe of characters for this to work, gave me the total freedom to tell the story exactly my own way. And we had gone from the age of Reagan to the age of Bush. You know, it was just around the time, you know, right after Obama was elected is when this came out, so all the Bush years were still very fresh. And the story ended up running a lot deeper, probably, than it would have run in the original version, you know? That said, I still think, you know, had I done it back in 1983, it would have been like a bomb going off in a good way in the Marvel universe. I think it would have been a really, really powerful, memorable story. But I'm just glad I finally got to do it all those years later, and I'm very, very proud of the way it turned out, you know.
I'm going to read this. I'm looking at it right now. I'm going to pick this up, Jam.
Let me know what you think, because I really think, especially, you know, knowing what you like, I think you will really enjoy it. But to go back to this comic that you're talking about, I told you before we started, I pulled it out. I haven't looked at it in a really long time, and I'm flipping through it. And this is, you know, this is the first time I ever worked with Mike Zett. You know, we went on to do a lot of work on Cap together, and then Kraven's Last Hunt, which has gone on to become this story that has followed us both around for 30 years. You know, in a good way, in a very good way.
I like how you refer to it like that.
Yeah, you know, but it's like, you know, not every story follows you around like that, where 30 years later, all, you know, people just want to talk about it and ask you questions about it, and they keep reprinting it. But anyway, this was the first time Mike and I worked together. I'm flipping through this, and even then, you know, both of us, very early in our careers, he was so damn good. His Red Skull is fantastic.
Oh,
you know,
wonderful,
just amazing. And you know, this, and his, you know, it's not like a guy in a skull mask. This is a guy who looks like he's a skull. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's just fantastic. Just there's one thing that we, let's hear where I look at it. It's a profile, and his mouth is open. And it's just eerie and frightening and horrible in a great way, you know. Mike is such a good artist, and one of the things I'm grateful to Captain America for is for putting us together and allowing us then to continue to work together, you know, years later, and to do that Kraven story together. So this was the first time that we ever did it.
Yeah, when I think of Captain America in a comic book, I think of how he looks by Mike Zeck. I think Mike Zeck is it's just, I mean, you know, Jack Kirby's probably, you know, the Captain America artist, but Zeck,
right.
Zeck is the one I sort of grew up on.
Right.
This was the guy that
right.
I saw, and I just love his, the sort of, you know, the muscular form that Zeck gives. He was great at action.
Storytelling is impeccable. You know, as a writer, you know, when you're writing Marvel style, we'll write a detailed plot, and then the artist will do the pencils from the plot, and then you get the pages back, and you dialogue from the art. And what I always say about Mike's stuff, it's his storytelling is so clear. You know, there's no question of what's going on in the panel, so you never have to explain the action as you have to do sometimes, where like the, you know, the storytelling isn't clear, and you have to suddenly put in captions or dialogue that are actually explaining what's happening in the panel. The other thing that he was so great at doing is all the emotions, the surface emotions, are all there in the characters. You know, you can feel what they're feeling just by looking at them, which allows me as a writer to take things to the next level deeper. That's one of the things that really worked well with the Kraven story, was everything, you know, visually it was all there. So you look at the story, and the whole story is interior monologues for these characters, because I didn't have to explain what was happening in the level one action. So I could go down to level two and level three and level four through these monologues. And that's because Mike is so, so good at what he does. He is a master. I'm very grateful that we got to work together on so many things.
Did you deal with him directly much when you were doing these comics, or just because of the Marvel style, you just didn't really need to?
Well, you know, what I recall, you know, in the beginning, you know, especially like on a story like the one we're talking about, it's like, here's this plot. I didn't even know who Mike Zeck was at that point, you know, just happy to get this great artwork back. But then once you're working on a book together month after month, you know, we would talk on the phone, and over time we became friends, and we would talk, and there was a personal connection there. So it wasn't just like, here's the plot, draw it, comes back, which happens sometimes too. You can work on a book for quite a while and never have contact with your artist. The editor is the one who has all the contact with the creative team. But Mike and I got to know each other and became friends. So that was another nice part of the association with Cap, that it connected us, not just professionally, but personally. And I hadn't seen him in years. And then last spring, we were at a convention in New Jersey, East Coast Comic Con, and we did a 30th anniversary Kraven's Last Hunt panel, is what I'm talking about, with the story following us around. Basically, the entire creative team, everyone but the colors, Jim Salicrup was there, Mike, our inker, our letterer, I mean, everybody was there. And we had not, I don't think we had ever been all in a room together at the same time, which is really amazing, you know? It was great. It was really, really great. And I hadn't seen Mike in many years, so that was really wonderful to see him there.
That's super. Yeah, I bought this comic off the stands. I was so excited that I sort of made sure I got it into a photo that they were taking of us on vacation. And in fact, the family friend who took the photo that appears in the gallery page, I had him pose with the comic as well.
Oh, that's
I was
fun.
So excited. And he was not to diverge too far from what we're here to talk about, but he was one of those family friends that, and I'm sure everybody's dealt with this, where, you know, you meet your parents' friends, and most of your parents' friends talk to you like you're a kid, because
right.
you are a kid. He never did that. He always talked to me like an adult, and he loved comic books, and so he was fascinated by all the comics I was reading, and he grew up reading Captain America in the 40s.
Wow.
And so he was just fascinated that they were like still making Captain America. And he was like, oh, what's going on? So I have a photo of him holding this issue, and I'm taking the photo. And I
oh,
just,
that's fantastic.
It's one of my warmest memories of this man, because his name was Bill. He was a great guy. And he just was just so willing to sort of engage with, you know, the 10-year-old me, which I always appreciated. So this comic is on top of it just being great. I just think it's one of the great Captain America runs. This particular issue was just really beloved to me, because I think about that time of when I just could sit there and talk to an adult about something right. I was interested in, and he was engaging with me, and it was great.
And it's not like, you know, it's not like today where these characters are everywhere in all media. You know, comics are still really, the average adult really look down their nose at this stuff. So I could imagine having a grown-up, you know, sit and talk to you about comic books must have been like revelatory, you know?
It was fantastic. It was great.
That's great. That's really a great story.
So, I mean, that's really it. I mean, I just love this comic so much. I do think this is, one of the great Captain America runs. If you go back, everybody, and you go to, like, Mike's Amazing World, and you just click through all the covers of all the ones that JM and Mike Zeck, or later Paul Neary, worked on, this is an extraordinary run of Captain America stories. And it follows a previous run. You mentioned the Roger Stern, John Byrne, which are really great. So Cap was in a really good place. This time creatively. I don't know, sales. I should ask you, was Captain America like a big seller or moderate seller? Do you remember that?
You know, it was probably from Marvel of the day a moderate seller. And those sales today, it would be considered, a top seller.
Right.
You know,
right.
Because I remember Marvel in those days, the minute a book dipped below 100,000 copies a month, it was on the chopping block. You know, now 100,000 and you're the top seller.
Yeah, wow.
You know, but times have changed, and so have cover prices, so that sort of accounts for some of it. But, you know, as everyone talks about, we live in a world of fractured media where everybody's time and attention is spread out in a lot of different ways, and nothing is the same. TV ratings aren't the same. Nothing, you know, music sales aren't the same. Everything, the whole entertainment landscape has shifted. So, you know, the comics are still here and doing reasonably well is a wonderful and miraculous thing for all of us, you know. I'm trying to think if there's anything else of profound interest to say about this story, but not really. Again, for me, it was just the beginning, and I didn't expect to be doing any Captain America once that was over. But once it was over, I guess Jim Salakrup liked what I did, and I think they had a couple of fill-in or two after that, and then he asked me to come on and be the regular writer on the book. And the thing that I've come to appreciate is when it was coming out, talking about sales and whatever else, I don't remember getting any great response to the book in any direction. People didn't hate it. I remember people loving it. But what I've seen as time has passed, and I don't know whether it's the fact that people like you that were reading it as kids are now adults, or the fact that Captain America is now much more popular through the movies and people are going back. But I find that this, you know, when I go do these kind of interviews, when I go to conventions, that Captain America run has become hugely popular, and so many people come up to me to talk about it. And, you know, considering that at the time, nobody really did, it's really very gratifying that it too has had staying power. And I would love to see Marvel do a real collection of this stuff. I think someone got in touch with me. I think it was either in Italy or in Spain. I think it's Italy. They're doing a big kind of omnibus edition of all our stuff.
Oh, from wow. The front,
which is great, you know, if you're Italian.
Yeah.
But if you're living here, it's, unless you speak fluent Italian, it's not going to help you too much, you know. So some of those stories have been reprinted in different places along the way over the years in different collections. But I would love to see a big omnibus. You know, next week the Justice League International omnibus is coming out with the first 2.5 years of the run I did with Giffen and McGuire and everyone else. And I got my copies last week, and it's like this massive 1,100 pages, giant hardcover thing. And you sit and you look at it and you go, holy crap, we wrote all those? You know? Really amazing, and they still hold up, and people are still reading them and buying them. I would love to see something like that for Captain America, if not a giant omnibus, at least a few, you know, a series of trade paperbacks or something collecting that whole run. I think it would be great to see them all. But obviously, I am prejudiced in that arena.
No, it would be nice. Except, as far as I can tell, the essential Captain America books stop just before they get to your stuff, because there's a volume 7 that has Roger Stern's, and then it seems to end just before they get to you, unfortunately.
Well, that's nice of them.
Yeah, we got to work on that. We got to get a petition into Marvel Comics.
Let's get volume 8 going here. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. This is great stuff. So, well, JM, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this. I mean, I don't want to embarrass you, but I can't help it. I mean, like, you know, if the current me could go back in time and tell the 10-year-old me that who was sitting on the porch looking out over the lake and reading this comic book and just finding it to be amazing, that I would someday be able to talk to the guy who wrote it, I'd be like, get the hell out of here. That's not going to happen. That's, you know. So I'm really enjoying the hell out of this, that I just get to talk
well,
to
thank
about
you.
This.
And I really, really appreciate that. And I totally understand that, because I've often said, if I could go back in time to 10-year-old me and tell him, you know, you're going to grow up and you're going to write Spider-Man and Justice League and Captain America, he would just faint. You know, I mean, it would be too overwhelming. He couldn't be able to handle it. I would just faint, you know? So, and that's what's so nice, really, one of the things about comics, and whether you're a reader or a creator, is that it keeps that kid alive in us, you know? It keeps our eyes wide with a sense of wonder and magic. And that's really, really valuable. Really a valuable thing. So I am happy and grateful that this comic means that much to you and that we had a chance to talk about it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So where can people find you on the internet, and why don't you tell people like what you're working on? I mean, you mentioned the Justice League trade, but what other projects you got coming up?
Well, first of all, if you want to find me, Twitter is always a good place. I'm very, very active on Twitter. Really enjoy it. I also have an official Facebook page there. So it's and a website, jamedmateus.com. I really, really enjoy the back and forth. So anyone that's going to, you know, ask me a question on Twitter or something on Facebook, I will always do my best to respond. Because I think it's one of the great things that social media has done is sort of removed one more wall between the creator and the audience. And I really, really appreciate that. Because I remember as a kid, you know, when I was like in junior high school, I used to love writing these letters to Marvel. You know, dear Stan, I love this issue. And if it would get printed and there would be a response, oh, my God, you know, it blew my mind. Again, going back in time to the young self, you know. In terms of what I'm working on right now, Keith Giffen and I at DC every month, we're writing Scooby Apocalypse, which is a very strange inversion of the Scooby-Doo show, written for an older audience. It's sort of a horror comedy, I guess you would call it. I always reference Zombieland. The movie Zombieland is sort of a way to get people to get what we're doing there. It's very character-driven. There's a lot of humor, but the horror is very real. And we're having – if anyone would have told me I would be having a great time doing Scooby Apocalypse, I would have said you're crazy. And it's been so much fun working on this book. We're in our second year, and we have no signs of stopping at the moment. So that's great. I have two creator-owned projects that I'm working on right now. They won't be out till the latter half of 2018. One is for IDW with Mike Cavallaro, the artist I mentioned who did The Life and Times of Xavier 28 with me. It's called Impossible Incorporated. It's sort of a big science fiction-y adventure in the grand Kirby tradition, but with a more of a contemporary spin to it. And then there's another one that unfortunately I can't talk about because I just can't.
Fair enough.
It hasn't been officially announced yet, but it's more in line with my more serious Vertigo creator-owned work. Impossible Inc. is a big, fun cosmic adventure, and this is a little bit darker and twistier and more personal in that way. But it will be announced probably sometime early next year, and I'm very, very excited about that too. In terms of things that are out there in new editions, there are a lot of things that have been reprinted this year. I mentioned Justice League International. Just a few weeks back, the Hero Squared, a creator-owned project I did with Keith Giffen, I think the best thing Keith and I have ever done together. Boom Studios just put out a big omnibus edition of that. Very proud of that. If you love the work that I do with Keith, I would highly recommend that. Earlier in the year, Dover Books put out a big collected edition of Seekers into the Mystery, which was a Vertigo series that I did. It's never been collected before. Very happy with that. And at the end of the year, Boom is putting out a new hardcover sort of ultimate edition of a series I did for them with Mike Ploog, the great Mike Ploog, called The Stardust Kid. So that's coming out. And along with that, I continue to work in animation. I've recently done a couple of episodes of the animated Spider-Man series. And I have a really, really big animation project coming out in 2018 that I would love to talk to you about, and I'm not allowed to.
Okay.
But it'll be announced also. They might be announcing at New York Comic Con, whether my involvement with it will be announced or not. But it'll be coming out in 2018. and it will please, I think, comic book fans. And it's maybe one of the very, very best animated projects I've been involved with. And I've done a lot of animation the past 15 years or so. And this one's really one of the best projects I've ever done. So I'm very excited about that, too. And, you know, always new things. There are always new projects brewing. And but that's the stuff I can talk about.
Wow.
Or some of it. Obviously, some of it I'm talking about it without talking about it. But at least I can at least do that much.
Right, right, right. It's coming. It's coming, people. It's coming.
It's coming. Yeah, exactly.
Well, excellent. Well, again, Jam, thank you so much. This was so much fun talking to you. And I really enjoyed reading these Cap comics. I think they're just terrific. And I was glad I had a chance to tell you. So thank you so much for doing
the show. Yeah, well, thank you, Rob. Thanks so much. And I hope maybe we'll get a chance to talk again soon.
Absolutely. So everybody, of course, if you want to listen to back episodes of this series or any of our other shows on the network, just go to fireandwaterpodcast.com. Please leave us a comment, and you can follow us over on Twitter, which is at FWPodcast. So again, thanks everybody for listening, and until the next episode, JM and I are just going to sit out and look out over Lake Wallenpaupack and have a beer or two and talk about Captain America and some other stuff. So we will see you all later. Bye.
When Captain America throws his mighty shield, all those who chose to oppose his shield must yield. If he's led to a fight and a duel is due, then the red and the white and the blue will come through. When